one occasion, as a young boy, that as it neared the holiday season, we would occasionally, as we would set up a tree or decorations or whatever we would be doing, we would occasionally set a few presents under the tree ahead of time that we were buying for each other. And those presents would be there. And as a young boy, normally that didn't mean that I had put any under there. I was only interested in the ones that were put under there that might have my name on them. I remember on every occasion we were told to leave them alone. We weren't supposed to pick them up. We weren't supposed to shake them. Above all, we weren't even to consider trying to open them to find out what was in them. But on this one occasion, I remember that as I was the only one at home, and there were several presents that were under the tree, and one that was wrapped particularly attractively that had my name on it, I lasted as long as I could. I put up with it for what seemed an eternity, probably amounting to 5 or 10 minutes would be my guess. But I began to pick it up and shake it a little bit and try to figure out some things, and I really couldn't tell. And so I started to think in my mind, what's the best way to go about opening this so that you don't tear it up and get recognized? Because I know that I had no hope of rewrapping it the way it had been wrapped. It was one of those in the store professionally wrapped with all the ribbon, the bow, and everything on it. And I eventually determined that if I could just get a kitchen knife, that I could slice that tape in just the right place and open it up and slide it out one end and determine what was in that box. And I did that. And being the, and I don't remember how old I was, I'm guessing 12 or 13, something like that, but being the creative young man that I was determined that I could fold that back in its own creases and put it back under the tree after I had determined what it was, and no one would be the wiser. They were the wiser. It didn't take them long to determine, based on things that I said, because then I was excited because I knew what I had coming. And so I started talking about, you know what I'd really like for Christmas? And I started naming the one thing, including the color that it was, that was in that box. And so it wasn't difficult for them to understand. But I'm telling you, I genuinely thought that I sat there on that sofa and looked at that present and did everything that I possibly could to convince myself that I shouldn't open that and that I needed to walk away, and I did all that I could. And yet I still caved, and probably, if somebody had a timer on it, caved very quickly. We've been talking about fruits of the Spirit and talking about the idea of sun-ripened fruit and what that means and what it means to be unique and different than the world around us so that people might see that we are followers of Jesus Christ and that we might understand what it means to be Christ-like and that they might see what it is to be Christ-like, what truly differentiates us from where we were before we came to Jesus Christ. And so that's how we've been looking at all of these things that make us unique to others in the world. And we want to talk this morning about the idea of self-control. Don't know if you really think in terms of that particular picture as being sun-ripened fruit, but that is coconut that is almost ripe right there. If you've ever seen coconut, it'll get a little bit browner than that on the outside, and it'll be ready to be taken down, or it will fall down from that tree, and you'll be able to get into it. And some of you like coconut, some of you don't. I understand that, but I would tell you it's a good representation, at least to me, of what we're talking about this morning when we talk about self-control. Because you ever tried to get into one? I mean, it's not like an apple. You know, there's a lot of fruit. It's not like a berry or a banana It's not something that's just easy to get to the fruit part and to be able to eat it. I remember the first time I tried to get into a coconut without having the proper kinds of tools, and you can do a lot of work, but I'd already been advised, don't bash it with a hammer. You can eventually crack it open with a hammer, but if you bash it with a hammer, you're going to lose all the milk that's inside, and you want that sweet coconut milk. And so to get the fruit the way that it's supposed to be is a difficult thing, and I think as we look at this particular fruit of the Spirit, this uniqueness, it seems to be a kind of almost a summation of so many of the other things that he's talked about. And with great difficulty does it come, but with great reward when you get it. And that is the idea of self-control. Real understanding of self-control. The thing that Paul is talking about as he writes to these brethren here. The word defined literally means to get a grip or to take hold of something. This is a description of somebody that is willing and able to get a grip on their lives, to take control of the areas of their life that will either bring success or bring failure. And Paul is saying, if you are Christ, one of the things that pictures Christ better than anything else was this unbelievable control that he had over self. His ability to do what he had to do regardless of what obstacle was put in front of him. And he says, if we're going to bear the fruit, that's what people are going to see in us. And so you talk about something that makes you unique. Because anybody can lose control of self. Anybody can fulfill self. Anybody can indulge self, but to control self, really control self, is not nearly as easy as we would like it to be. It's the power to keep oneself in check. It isn't that no thought ever crosses our mind, or it's not that anything never disturbs us or bothers us. How angry, how disgusted must Jesus have been on occasion? It isn't an issue of do we have the emotions? It's an issue of what do I do with the emotions? What am I doing to keep my life in check? It is the quality, and it goes way beyond just what we think of. We sometimes think of self-control mostly as it goes into the area of how we handle anger and anger issues. But it's way deeper than that. The Bible deals with that as well, but it's way deeper than that. This is the quality that allows us to get victory over the flesh that he's talked about earlier in this chapter. As Gerald read in our hearing just a moment ago. He says, this is a big war that's going on. And there's no fruit of the Spirit that displays that or demonstrates that better than self-control. He says, you have to understand, there is just a fight going on inside of us. And there are all kinds of fleshly desires that he lists. Some that are in that area of what we would say, you know, those things are heinous. Those aren't things that I would ever really think of being involved in at all. But others he lists that you think, wow. You know, just a little bit of envy or jealousy or some of the things that he talks about, those are things that we wrestle with. And he says that war is constantly going on. Plato uses this word here, self, that's translated self-control, uses it in his writings as the spirit that has mastered its desire. Paul said on one occasion, I'll not be mastered by anything. He wanted to master himself. It's a word that is used to describe an athlete and the discipline of an athlete's body. The things that they go through in order to accomplish what it is they've got to accomplish. That's the word that he's used. And we'll look at that in 1 Corinthians in a moment when it's used that way, that idea. God says, here's what's necessary if you're a Christian. Here's what people will see in you. People will see a kind of mastery over self that is athletic in its nature. I can still remember watching a thing on television one time where a guy was washing his cottage cheese. Not with soap, just water. But he had low-fat cottage cheese and rinsed it all off so he could make it even lower-fat cottage cheese. He was a runner, and I thought, that seems pretty extreme. But that was somebody that at least had mastered himself to the point to where he said, this is what I'm going to do, and that's what he did because he had some intended goal in all of that, as we'll see in a moment. Secular Greek uses this word pretty frequently. This is a word that was used of a few, but not many, emperors or leaders in the Grecian Empire and even in the Roman Empire. It's a word that was used to describe a leader who never allowed his own personal interest to trump the interest of his government or his people. Now, think how much you'd like to have that quality in all of those who lead us in any capacity. Never, never allow personal desire to enter the picture at all. In Proverbs, as it talks about this concept, it says, a person without self-control is like a city with broken down walls. That's the New Living Testament, Proverbs chapter 25, verse 28. It's just saying, think about this, because you need something to provide protection to you in life. And God has given us the means by which we can supply and have that protection. But he says, if you would just think about the idea of a city for them that was only protected because it had those walls. I mean, Jericho, that great city that was protected, was how protected when the walls crumbled? I mean, the Israelites just marched in and took over. That was the nature. The whole point of Proverbs is, if you don't have this quality in your life, you are just left absolutely unprotected. That's why it becomes so critically important. Why it is that I have to master myself. Why it is that I have to gain control over myself, because it is the means by which I receive that protection that God has promised. He's given me the things to put into place so that I can accomplish that. So I just want us to look at some things this morning. I want you to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, if you would, and just kind of mark yourself there. We're going to talk about that passage in a moment. I don't know if you've ever read any of John Maxwell's books. He writes a lot of books on leadership. And has written some very good things on leadership and the concepts of leadership and how to be a better leader, those kinds of things. He wrote these words. In reading about the lives of great people, and that's how he writes his books. He looks at great leaders and uses the principles that they used in order to help others become great leaders. In reading about the lives of great people, I found that the first victory that they won was over themselves. I think that's a great quote. But that is where it has to start, and I think that's what Paul's saying in Galatians chapter 5. Fruits of the Spirit, self-control. There was a sign in an office building that said, if you could kick the person responsible for most of your troubles, you wouldn't be able to sit down for a week. I thought, that's a good sign. Because it is. It's so easy sometimes for us to blame. And sometimes we do it in jest, and sometimes we do it seriously. Our class in our afternoon study is studying Philippians today. We're looking at Philippians chapter 2, the way that people bother us in our lives. And I've already kind of let that class in on something that's not really a huge secret. If you've ever driven with me, I don't always have the patience that I have with some of the other drivers. And I'm completely confident that it's them, it's not me. You ever been there? I'm just confident. But you know, maybe if I approached driving differently, they would be less of a problem. Do you ever think of that? That's what that sign is saying. It is so easy to be confident that it is my wife or your husband or my son or daughter or your son or daughter or my mother or father or my friend or my boss or my teacher. It's so easy to think that they're the source of our problems. When in actuality, I think God says,
all those people or people like them were in the life of Jesus, and yet he reacted differently.
So it can't be that it's them as much as it may be me.
I need to understand
that self-control is what will determine how all those other things in life affect me. Do I master myself? And it's used a lot of ways in the Scripture. We're not going to look at all of these, but in Proverbs chapter 29, he talks about anger, and we need to demonstrate self-control. That is a part of it. I can't just vent myself, as the writer of Proverbs says. I can't just decide I'm going to blow up because that's the way I deal with things. I need to control that anger side of that, because sometimes just what I say and how I react is a problem. In Proverbs chapter 6, he talks about, before he gets to that simple man in Proverbs chapter 7. In Proverbs chapter 6, he talks about, you know what? He says the price of a prostitute is a loaf of bread. That's kind of an interesting statement, isn't it? He says that after he says, be careful. He says, because I'm telling you, there's things that look attractive to you, but they're not what you think they are. So he talks about lust is something we have to control. We understand that. And in this society, how critically important is that? When television is not at all what television used to be, and movies aren't what movies used to be, and the ready access, as a matter of fact, I read an article this last week on television. I guess they are once again hearing arguments for whether or not there should be any censorship on primetime television. And may change that law entirely, so that any adult content that is presently outside of primetime hours can be on primetime hours on regular network television. It isn't. You can't just ignore the fact that it is out there, and we're in a society that's inundated with that. And he talks about that. He says, be careful. The sexual side of life has great appeal because God created it to have great appeal, but it has a proper way to be fulfilled in an improper way. And he says, you're going to have to control that lust. He talks about the wise man's house in Proverbs chapter 21. The wise man's house, he says, has oil and treasures and stuff in it. But he says, not the fool. He says, the fool has none of that because he spent it all. He says, you got to be careful. You can't just think in those terms that I don't have to concern myself at all with providing at all for my family in the long term at all. I just spend, and I don't need to control what I'm doing with my money at all. How many people and how many families have incredible problems in our country right now because they've spent themselves into problems? God says that's an area of self-control. Proverbs chapter 23 is that great description of the appeal of alcohol and what it does to us. In Proverbs chapter 23, before that, he talks about ambition, about the whole thing. He says, you look at the rich man or the king and you see all the stuff that he's got. He says, put a knife to your throat if you've got a desire for that. If that's where your ambition lies, he says, you just got to be careful with that. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Read with me, if you would, verse 24 to 27. That's what we want to take our lesson from this morning. And just a few points. A few points from that passage, and the lesson will be yours. Because they're not new things. We understand that. There are things that we understand, we just need to be reminded of from time to time. Paul says, do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I've preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. That's a great, just a great explanation of what is necessary
to accomplish the self-control that we need to have in our lives? How is it that I get this fruit in my life?
Three things. Three traits that show up in those that have control over self.
And I think Paul addresses all three of them in this passage.
One is they've got purpose. They've got purpose. I grew up from the time I was very young with a young boy by the name of Butch. He was the same age as I was. We were in the same class. We did things together. We called him Butch on occasion, but more often than not, we didn't call him Butch. We called him Butterball. And I'm not saying that's a good thing or recommending that to you. I'm just saying that's what we called him because kids aren't always as nice as they ought to be. And we called him Butterball. You know, when you think of Butterball, when I grew up, Butterball always had reference to a turkey. And that's why we called him Butterball. You ever gone in the store and just picked one of those up? It's got little arms sticking out and little legs sticking out, but it's got a pretty rotund body that the arms and the legs are sticking out of. And so we weren't too kind to Butch, but that was just he understood that. That was his nickname. We just kind of teased him that way. If we didn't call him Butterball, we called him Rock and Roll, because if you rocked him, he rolled. So he was no better off either way. We got to seniors in high school. I played baseball and football up to that time. He really didn't. He was not very athletic, and that was just based because of his size. After seniors in high school, he signed up for the military, which shocked us all because he was as liberal politically and as anti-establishment as anybody else I knew in the 70s, but he joined the service. He had 6 months before he had to actually report based on when he had signed up. He started an exercise program because he was determined that he was not going to be bounced from boot camp, or that he was not going to go to boot camp in such a shape that he couldn't make it through without incredible suffering. He thought better to suffer now instead of suffering then. And so he started a training regimen and he ran and he ran. And I'd never known him to run before in his life, but he ran. And he ran. And I remember before he even joined the service, as I was talking to him on one occasion, he said, "Hey," he says, "you interested in joining me? I'm running a marathon." I thought, you've lost your mind. You think I'm interested in joining you? But he did. He ran a marathon. I've never to date, as much fun as I ever made of him, I've never to date even attempted something like that. But he did. And why? Because he had absolute purpose as to what he was going to do, and he changed his whole life because he had a goal set in front of him, and he put that goal out there and said, "This is what I'm going to do, and whatever it takes, that's what I'm going to do." And so he didn't eat with us at Burger King anymore when we used to eat on a daily basis from school at Burger King or McDonald's or whatever else. He skipped all of those. He didn't go with us the places we went where we were just lounging around. He's out running and he's working weights and exercising, but he had purpose. And I would tell you, that's what Paul says. Paul said, those that run the race have purpose. There's no point in getting in the race if you're not going to win the race. Why would you join the race if you're not going to try to win the race? He says, don't we understand? Everybody who runs, runs to win. Otherwise, don't run. We understand that concept. Any sport that we play, that seems to be that's the concept behind it, isn't it? People play football to win. They keep score. They award the guy that crosses the finish line first in a race. There's a reason for all of that, because that's what we're striving for. Paul says that's the case in this life. If I want to be God-like, Christ-like, if I want to have the control that Jesus Christ had, I'm going to have to set that as a purpose in my life. I'm going to be what He wants me to be, not what I've always wanted to be. You think about that interest we have in ourselves. You think about that song that we sang just a minute ago. Isn't that a great song when you think about this concept? Look at Psalm 3 again in the supplement. Don't you just love some of the words in that song? This undistracted mind, tear from my heart the cares that leave me blind. Sever me
from all things that hide your face. Fill me with you, you only I embrace. See, that's a life of purpose. That's what you're asking for when you sing a song like that. Give me purpose, God. I want nothing more than to be yours in the way that you want me to be. Fill it with thoughts for which it was designed. He's just saying, God, help me to think about what you wanted me to think about. You've made me free to dwell on what I ought. Make me to dwell on you, my greatest thought. Give me this undistracted mind. Hone it to seek the things you'd have it find. Sharpen my thought and only let me dare come unto you with a single-minded care. Just as your son's own mind was pure and kind, Enos's heart was bent upon your will. So keep my mind so focused and so still. Isn't that a great song of self-control? It just says, God, I need purpose. Give me purpose in life, and may I follow that purpose. Secondly, he says it's a life of discipline. We got a video message from Jonathan and Kara,
I don't know, maybe a month ago now, that we thought was pretty amusing. I mean, Carter is on the video, and numerous ones here have met Carter. He's kind of a character all his own, like most kids that are 4 years old. Jonathan says, you can see Carter. Jonathan's holding the phone. You can see Carter. He says, okay, Carter, it's recording. What do you want to say? Carter goes, hi, Grandma. Hi, Grandpa. I miss you. I'm going to punch myself in the face. And that's what he does. He just hauls off, hits himself right in the eye, falls backwards onto the floor. And we got a big kick out of that. We're laughing. Hopefully he wasn't hurt. We saw him not too long after that. He wasn't a black eye or anything, so maybe he went easy on himself. But you know, that's the word Paul uses here. When Paul says, I buffet or I discipline my body, that word is literally to strike oneself or to hit oneself in the eye. Think about that. Paul says, I'm gonna do whatever it takes. I'm going to knock myself out in order to please God. That's the kind of discipline that it takes. Somebody who is willing to put every bit into it. This idea of hitting under the eye says, without discipline, I'll never get where I need to be. And Paul says, so it takes that how often, Paul? Every single day I buffet myself. Every day I understand what Jesus said when he said the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. If I don't put myself in position every day to work on that, then I'm going to yield some places that I shouldn't yield. Finally, it's submission. It's giving oneself over to something bigger than self. I've disciplined my body and bring it into subjection. He says, I've got to submit myself to God's self. That's what that song is all about. That's the submission side of that. God, you do whatever it takes. I'm going to submit myself. He talks about rules in that passage. He says, you know what? There's rules when you run. And you live by those rules. And I think that's exactly what God tells us as well. If I'm going to submit myself to Him, it is me saying, you know what? My goal is to please God. I'll live by your will, not mine. Whatever you ask me to do, that's what I'll do. I think that's submission of our bodies. And saying, God, I'm going to do what is necessary. And I recognize things about this body. In other words, the fleshly side. And when we, like, to give you an example, when we meet with the high schoolers and those that are of dating age and talk about, you know, you want to know why it's important, why Paul said what he did in Romans when he told them, don't make a provision for the flesh. He said, it doesn't matter how strong you think you are. You put somebody in a position to yield, and we're in great danger of yielding. He just says, be careful with that. There were reasons. It wasn't just to spoil your fun that mom and dad set some of the rules they did. They understood the nature of the provisions of the flesh. And he says, don't make a provision for the flesh
to fulfill its desires, its lust. It needs to be our bodies. And Paul says, we need to buffet our body daily. And sometimes that means I need to just remove myself from those that would take me the wrong direction or from the situation that would allow me to yield. But then secondly, it's in our minds as well. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul talks about this war. And he says, we're fighting against powers that aren't really of this world like we think about of this world. But he talks about bringing every thought into captivity, capturing every thought of the mind. He's not saying that your mind will never have a wrong thought, but he says, I've got the ability to keep the thoughts of the mind captivated so I can do with those thoughts what I need to do with them. He says that's where it starts. Am I disciplining myself to capture my mind so that God can have my mind first? Because if He has my mind above all things and I've got the purpose and the discipline in my life, submitting myself to His will, He says that's where it starts. Bring that mind captive. You need to do that. I need to do that. Self-control. It's an incredible fruit. But there is no question that it is, in fact, a fruit that is as hard sometimes to crack as a coconut. Work hard. Work hard at understanding that to gain this wonderful fruit of God that will yield all those benefits from all those other fruits, God says you just need to understand how hard you have to work at it. May we show to the world that with Christ on our side, we are not a people who are seeking to fulfill ourselves, but a people who have mastered ourselves, seeking to fulfill our God. If we can help you do that today, let us know while we stand and sing.
I am a fool.